the sole authority to order a weapon's use. The military had gained far too much power over the nuclear arsenal since the days of Harry Truman, McNamara thought, and the lack of civilian oversight at NATO was chilling. The Davy Crockett recoilless rifle was especially problematic. Its atomic projectiles weighed about 50 pounds and would be easy to steal. They were small enough to fit in a duffel bag or a backpack. After reading the Joint Committee's report, President Kennedy halted the dispersal of nuclear weapons among America's NATO allies. Studies on weapon safety and command and control were commissioned. At Sandia, the development of coded electromechanical locks was begun on a crash basis. Known at first as prescribed action links, the locks were given a new name, one that sounded less restrictive, in the hopes of appeasing the military. Permissive action links sounded more friendly, as did the acronym PALS. Within 7 weeks of President Kennedy's inauguration, the broad outlines of his defense policies were set. Spending on conventional forces would increase, more Polaris submarines would be built, and intercontinental ballistic missiles would largely replace bombers. Missiles were thought to be faster, cheaper, and less likely to be destroyed in a surprise attack. The Atlases, Titans, Jupiters, and Thors, so recently rushed into service, would be decommissioned as soon as possible. Less expensive, solid-fueled missiles would replace them. McNamara and his team had come to believe that nuclear weapons with a lower yield were more cost-effective. The Minuteman missile carried a 1 megaton warhead, and calculations suggested that 5 of them would inflict more damage than a single 9 megaton warhead carried by a Titan II. Nevertheless, a relatively small number of Titan II missiles would be retained for the time being. They would be useful for destroying naval bases, missile complexes, and underground command centers. The Polaris submarine seemed like the ideal weapon system for the Kennedy administration's strategic goals. The 16 missiles on each sub would serve as a powerful deterrent to the Soviets, greatly increasing the odds that the United States could offer some sort of nuclear response after a surprise attack. Safely hidden beneath the ocean, the submarines could also give the president more time to think or negotiate during a crisis. In 1958, the Navy had requested a dozen Polaris subs. Facing intense pressure from Congress, Eisenhower later agreed to deploy 19. Kennedy decided to build 41. The 656 missiles of the Polaris fleet would be aimed solely at counter-value targets, at civilians who lived in the major cities of the Soviet Union. The Air Force didn't like most of the Pentagon's new spending priorities, which seemed to favor the Army and the Navy. The B-47 bomber, long the mainstay of the Strategic Air Command and the favorite ride of Colonel Jimmy Stewart, was to be taken out of service. No additional B-52 bombers would be built. The fate of a supersonic replacement for the B-52 was suddenly uncertain, and plans for a nuclear-powered bomber were scrapped. McNamara had concluded that bombers were not only too costly to operate, but increasingly vulnerable to Soviet air defenses. The B-47 and the B-52 had been designed for high-altitude bombing. They would now have to attack at low altitudes to avoid Soviet radar. And the Soviets were beginning to put atomic warheads on their anti-aircraft missiles as well. During an attack on the Soviet Union, about half of SAC's bomber crews, if not more, were expected to lose their lives. General Curtis LeMay, the second in command at the Air Force, had little use for McNamara and his whiz kids. Few of them had served in the armed forces, let alone seen combat, yet they acted like military experts. They seemed arrogant and clueless. General Thomas D. White, the Air Force chief of staff, had similar misgivings, later criticizing the pipe-smoking, tree-full-of-owls type of so-called professional defense intellectuals who have been brought into this nation's capital. LeMay was convinced that long-range bombers were still the best weapons for strategic warfare. The Pentagon had never allowed SAC to test launch a ballistic missile with a live nuclear warhead, despite many requests. Such a launch, with a flight path over the United States, was considered too risky. Dummy warheads were successfully tested instead on missiles fired from Vandenberg, and the same fusing and firing mechanisms would presumably detonate a real one. But LeMay didn't want the survival of the United States to depend on a weapon that had never been fully tested, and the idea of a limited war still seemed ridiculous to him. The phrase was an oxymoron. If you won't fight to win, LeMay argued, then you damn well shouldn't fight. His protege at SAC, General Power, felt the same way and continued to push for a counterforce strategy, aiming at military targets. For that task, Polaris missiles, relatively inaccurate and impossible to launch simultaneously as one massive salvo, were useless. To placate the Air Force and gain additional security against a surprise attack, McNamara raised the proportion of SAC bombers on ground alert from one-third to one-half. The number of bombers on airborne alert was increased as well. 12 B-52s were soon in the air at all times, loaded with thermonuclear weapons, as part of Operation Chrome Dome. Every day, six of the bombers would head north and circumnavigate the perimeter of Canada. Four would cross the Atlantic and circle the Mediterranean, and two would fly to the ballistic missile early warning facility in Thule, Greenland, and orbit it for hours, maintaining visual or radio contact with the base, just to make sure that it was still there. Thule would probably be hit by Soviet missiles during the initial stage of a surprise attack. Known as the Thule Monitor, the B-52 assured SAC more reliably than any bomb alarm system that the United States was not yet at war. Feuds between the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force continued despite McNamara's vow that the Pentagon would have one defense policy, not three conflicting defense policies. Inter-service rivalries once again complicated the effort to develop a rational nuclear strategy. The Joint Chiefs of Staff had been instructed to alter the PSYOP so that President Kennedy would have a number of options during a nuclear war. Studies were underway to make that possible. But the nuclear ambitions of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force still seemed incompatible, and at times, incomprehensible. General Maxwell Taylor had contended in his best-selling book that the Army needed more money to fight conventional wars, an argument that helped to make him the principal military advisor to President Kennedy. Nevertheless, with Taylor's support, the Army